thank you for giving me the opportunity to give the talk. So hello everyone. My name is Alexandra Veledina. I'm from Nordit in Sweden. And today I'll talk about spectral and timing properties of accreting black holes, and the talk which is very much related to our earlier discussion. So I would be really happy if we have this discussion continued. So please ask me questions during my talk. I'll start with the general outline. So I'll just describe general properties of accreting black holes, their spectra, and then we'll go to the variability in both optical and X-rays. And then I'll describe the long-term behavior of the systems. So accreting black holes, what are these beasts? They are black holes in binary systems, where you have like matter which is transferred from a companion star towards the compact object, and these are like about 20 systems which are sketched here, where we know more or less inclinations and the sizes. So this is the size of this is the Sun, this is the Mercury, it's the distance, and if you compare most of them are. Most of the sketches here are much less, they have separation much less than the distance from the Sun to Mercury. So very compact, and they have periods varying from 3 hours to about 33 days. So far there are about 25 confirmed black holes, which means we have dynamical mass measurements in these systems, which are in excess, which are more than like three solar masses. And the heaviest ones achieve even 15 solar masses. So first of all, the spectra which the black hole binaries show, the famous Q diagram, which we already discussed today. So as the system goes in outburst, its X-ray luminosity increases, but this is the luminosity here in X per second, and here is the X-ray color. So as the outburst starts, we come from this point up here. But at some point, not only the X-ray luminosity increases, but also the spectrum changes, and the object goes from the hard state to the soft state here, and then it spends some time here and goes like at the decline of the outburst, it goes down and then it goes back to the hard state again, which we see as the Q loop in this diagram. So these are several outbursts of one system in 2002, 2004, and 2007, which are plotted with different colors. We see that all of them follow more or less the same Q loop, so there is no like spread over these points here. There is actually like specific tracks here. But at the same time, when the systems go further down, when the X-ray luminosity drops even further, we sometimes observe that the X-ray color becomes smaller again, or like at the same time the spectrum softens again. So this is well seen here. This is unfortunately in a little bit different shape. So this is the luminosity in terms of Eddington luminosity. This is 10 to minus 2. And this is the spectral slope. So these are soft spectra, these are harder spectra. And as the X-ray luminosity drops, we can see that first the object hardens, but then below something about 10 to minus 2, it might soften again. And it's rather puzzling behavior, which I will try to explain in my talk. So the X-ray spectra are connected to different geometries here. So in the hard state, let's start with the soft state. In the soft state, we think that the optically thick, geometrically thin disk is going all the way down to the black hole. And what we see in the X-rays, in the soft X-rays, is just the thermal emission, at top of which we sometimes also see some tails here. And we attribute this to the corona-like structures, which are like hot gas atop of the disk. But it's not what happens in the hard state. In the hard state, we have the power law in the X-ray band, picking up at about 100 keV. And the main process involved here is the comptonization of some soft photons to hard X-rays. The geometry in this state is different, and we think that the disk is truncated far away from the black hole. And the innermost parts of the accretion disk, of the cold accretion disk, is occupied by the hot, probably radiatively inefficient accretion flow. But the main point here is that it's optically thin, means that the optical depth of the order of unity. So these are the differences between two spectral states. And let's have a look at the hard X-ray spectral state again. So what happens here is that we have the comptonization. So we have some soft photons which are coming to the hot medium where we have like about 100 keV electrons, and they get upscattered. So like multiple upscatterings produces you the comptonization continuum, which is then cut off at about like at the order of magnitude the temperature of the electrons here. So that's how we get the power law. But the main question for the hard state is, where do we get the soft photons from? And there are two views on that. One is that we still have a thin accretion disk, and it can provide the soft photons, which are then comptonized, upscattered to the hard X-rays. And the problem with this scenario is that if we think that the disk starts to recede from the innermost stable orbit back, then we should see the decrease of soft flux, which means that we should see the spectrum should harden and harden again. But we actually, what we see is that the hard track there, the spectrum stays, this has the same hardness. It's just the power law drops in the luminosity. And like another argument against this scenario would be that we can measure the disk inner radius, and it can be about 100 Schwarzschild radii. And we know that the X-rays are coming from very close to the black hole, which means like 10 Schwarzschild radii. So if you calculate what is the amount of soft photons penetrating into this innermost parts from the disk, it will be like a factor of 1,000 below what you would want to have for the comptonization to operate. So there was another view that there is this hot accretion flow which can produce itself can produce photons, soft photons, which are coming from the synchrotron. And these synchrotron photons are then Compton upscattered by the same electrons which are there in the same hot medium. And this is called this EDF-like flows, which radiatively inefficient accretion flows. But the main problem with this scenario is that for the parameters which we can deduce from the observations, so like optical depth and say some like electron number density, in order to get the amount of soft photons from the thermal synchrotron, you have to have very very highly energetic electrons, because most of the photons, like synchrotron photons, are self-absorbed in the medium. So in order to get the high luminosity, you have to assume, or you will get rather high electron temperatures. So for these models, they typically get like above 200 like 300, 500. But this is not what is observed. So like what we observe is like a factor of 5 below. And that was the major problem with this kind of scenario. A way out of this was to consider the non-thermal particles. And like the first evidence comes from the Cygnus 6-1, where we have the X-ray spectrum here and the thermal cut, like the cutoff, which is a hallmark of thermal containerization. But at the same time, we observe the MEV, MEV photons. And the slope is shows you that these are non-thermal particles which are emitting here. The same non-thermal excess which was found in GX339-4 as well. So what you actually, if you have these non-thermal particles in the medium, what they produce is not only the high energy tails, but also they can increase the synchrotron luminosity by a factor of 100 to 1,000. And it was realized early enough in 2001 by these authors. But then the main question is to consider to calculate the spectrum of such particles in the hot medium. And the main problem is that once you say that we have, okay, we have like thermal particles and we have a non-thermal tail, which are both interacting in the medium with the photons, then you don't know what is the steady-state electron distribution because it's not anymore Maxwellian. So in order to calculate the spectrum of such configuration of particles, you have to calculate like electron distribution together with the photon distribution in the medium. And that's what is done here. This is so-called synchrotron self-contained mechanism. So here is the particle distribution and the particle momentum. And here is the luminosity and the photon energy. So what I plot here is like the electron distribution is consistent of the Maxwellian, which peaks at about like with temperature of about 100 keV. But then there is an additional non-thermal particle tail here. And this is the spectrum which they produce, a synchrotron self-Compton.
And, sorry, what is the fraction of energy in that non-thermal tail?
Yes, thank you for asking. It's very small. It's like in all calculations, it's 1 to 10%. So how this spectrum was calculated, actually, is that we assume that there is an electron acceleration in the medium. And you provide the energy input from this non-thermal particle, from the like, accelerated particle in the form of a power law. But then they interact in the medium. They produce synchrotron, they produce Compton, and then they thermalize here partially. And in the end, the amount of energy which is left in this tail is very small compared to the total energetics. So this electron distribution produces this spectrum, and here what I plot, the red is the emission of the like what is these electrons, the non-thermal electrons mostly produce. So the low energy part comes from the synchrotron photons, synchrotrons of Compton, or the synchrotron mechanism. Sorry. But at the same time, these non-thermal particles are responsible for this high energy part. Whereas the Maxwellian part of this distribution is responsible for the upscattering of the synchrotron photons to the 100 keV. So this is mostly thermal containerization with some small amount of non-thermal photons. And this fits very well with the hard state of the like hard state of the black hole. Which was shown in the paper, this spectrum is actually what you calculate from this. Like, this spectrum is calculated self-consistently with the electron distribution in the medium.
Just to clarify, so the non-thermal particles are leading the thermal particles, so to speak. The mechanism that energizes the system are first energizing the non-thermal particles. Subsequently, they thermalize.
Yes.
And in all of that, you're saying this is going on in the hot. So this, there's no thermal disk components?
In the calculations of the spectra, there is no disk which we assumed. I mean, there is of course disk, but
further out.
Yeah. And well, we probably don't see this here in the spectrum.
None of the thermal emission is coming from
None of the like cold accretion disk emission is taken into account. Yes. So this was for the X-ray spectra, and what we have when we go to the longer wavelengths, so we want to understand the broadband spectra of the low-mass X-ray binaries, which means we don't want to look at the star spectrum, but we want to see the something from in the optical. We want to see something which is connected to the accretion onto the objects. And one of these low-mass X-ray binary, XT1118, this is the broadband spectrum, it's quasi-simultaneous data. Here is the X-rays, the power law here, and it had an extremely low absorption, so it was possible quite well to observe it in the extremely ultraviolet wavelengths. There is also optical infrared here. And there are many observations in the radio. So when we try to decompose the spectrum into the components, so what we see here is probably the corona or the hot inner flow, whatever you want to call it. Then there is an accretion disk, like the standard accretion disk here. But because we know the period, we more or less know how far the disk extends, so we can predict this its shape here. And what the infrared points show us is that there is an excess above the accretion disk contribution, and even the irradiated accretion disk contribution, actually, in the system. And the question is, where does this radiation come from? And then when you try to plot the to extrapolate the radio points up, they seem to overpredict. Like there is one critical point here, and if you try to extrapolate here, you would overpredict this particular these points here. So it's probably not from the jet, and when you so it's not from the jet, it's not from the irradiated disk. Where it comes from? There is another good example of a radio faint X-ray binary, it's SWIFT 1753, where again you see these are just the data from different epochs, but you see the X-rays here, which you can extrapolate down, and they interestingly hit the optical points. At the same time, when you try to extrapolate the radio points, they seem to underpredict the optical points quite a lot. So again, probably in this case, the jet doesn't have to do anything with the optical or infrared emission in this object.
Alexandra, you commented that they weren't contemporaneous. Is that a possible problem with the variability?
In this object, if you just see, do you mean this object or the previous object?
You mentioned it for both, actually.
Yeah, well, for previous one, there are different data points, like different colors for different epochs, and you can see that it doesn't vary too much.
So
I mean, of course, it might happen so that we are just unlucky, but. Because you have different data sets and they're showing more or less the same, I would argue that.
But these slopes do not have to be very different for them to even connect up, which is, I mean, in a sense, it's surprising that they get this close already, right? Especially in the next object.
Well,
the extrapolation is pretty long.
Yeah, well, these are the here are the upper limits. So this is the most what you can get from the data. So actually, the points the real points will probably be below. But the previous one is the problem here is that what you have like here, the slope, is like of the order of zero, so like f nu is proportional to nu to zero. But here, the slope is plus 0.5, so you cannot really explain it with either optically thick part, like this self-absorbed part, neither with optically thin.
So a knee would be easy, an ankle is easier to explain than a knee, right? If you had an ankle.
Well, if you had like something like this in the data, like, you know, soft spectrum.
If it bends up, that would be easier to explain, I would think, bending this way, because this curve, you don't know where it's going to stop, and then the new mechanism comes in. But if it was an ankle, the top one would overshoot and naturally cut off the jet. If it was an ankle.
Well, I mean, if you extrapolate it, it's like above, right?
I just mean if it bent the other way. So this is going up and yes. Coming like this. So if it started flatter and then went steeper.
If it started flatter and then steeper.
Wouldn't that be easier to explain?
No, certainly not.
No?
No, but, well, in the jet hypothesis, like says standard jet, right? You have the multiple components here which produce you this self-absorbed part. But then at some point, this you come to the innermost parts, which means that you have, afterwards, you have a soft spectrum, like optically thin spectrum.
It's just that the jet could go off and you could have points above the bottom. Whereas if it were an angle, they would never.
Well, if you could explain some points if they were like soft here,
yeah.
But as far as they are hard and this slope does not correspond to this slope at all,
yeah, okay, yeah.
I think that's.
Yeah, I can raise the point.
I mean, here again, like this is an outburst peak, but in the decline, like when the object starts to decline, the radio points are even lower. So it's like the most you can get, but the optical stays there actually. So, what we propose is to consider the hot accretion flow, which is extending down to the optical infrared, and. For example, if we have a homogeneous part, like homogeneous accretion flow, this is the spectrum I showed you. This is the synchrotron self-Compton spectrum from one, say, homogeneous part, like in the most part of this system. But then, when you consider that the hot accretion flow is stratified, so you have like range of parameters, range of optical depths, range of magnetic fields, and so on. What you actually get is that you have the synchrotron peaks appearing at different wavelengths. And when you sum up all the spectra which is produced throughout this flow, you actually get this power law, which is very much consistent with the data. So this power law can be like 0.5, 0, or even minus 0.5, depending on the parameters. And in this case, you're not constrained by the slope which you get from the radio, because it's not from the jet. So this in this model, the innermost parts are radiating in the X-rays, like major X-rays are coming from the innermost parts. But the outer parts are mostly responsible for the optical and infrared emission here. And when you start to apply to the data, there are two objects we tried. One is 1753, which I showed already. So this is the X-ray spectra. And these are the optical infrared data points. Not infrared, just optical, probably UV here, yeah. And then, depending on what you assume for the absorption for this object, you either just hit these optical points with this one power law, or they can actually be a little bit above, but then you have to consider also the accretion disk contribution. So there are In the GX39 minus 4, you can also do it. There are these multiple components from this hot accretion flow. Like this is the most of the X-rays are coming from the innermost part. Then there is a disk and reprocessed, like a reprocessed emission from the disk. But then in the infrared, mid-infrared, you see again this hot accretion flow, which is emerging as the different slope for this object.
I mean, this layered hot accretion flow, I mean, so now you're introducing a bunch of extra free parameters, aren't you? Because you said you're going to bury the opacity and the magnetic fields and things in each of these layers, so.
Yeah, but I mean, introducing a jet would be additional component, which means again freedom in parameters, right? So you choose. I mean, you have to somehow explain the optical points, and the point is that you cannot explain it with the existing scenario. So you have to come up with something. Okay, so that was a part about the spectra, and then let's go to the variability. And then first, I would like to consider the aperiodic variability in the X-rays. We already heard a lot. So that the X-rays show power law, the power spectra of the X-rays, they show power law in about 0.1 to like about 10 hertz. So like here, which is well explained by the propagating fluctuations in the hot accretion flow. And that, again, this as the outburst proceeds, this lower frequency break is moving, and we attribute it to the moving outer edge of this hot accretion flow. And these are observables which explain, which show very more or less nicely fitting this power law here. But sometimes this power spectrum in the X-rays do not have at all like a power law. And they more resemble multiple peaks, which is usually modeled with multiple Lorentzians, with no like explanation why they are coming there. Like, why would you have these kind of Lorentzians? Why these frequencies? And there are a number of cases like that. And interestingly, we noticed that. These cases are often attributed to the so-called intermediate state. Well, not soft state, not the hard state, but the intermediate state. And at the same time, in the intermediate state, you can often see that spectra cannot be fitted by one component, one quantization component. You actually need two quantization continua to explain the data. So these are two, this COMPS1, COMPS2, and you can actually see that the spectra are not power law there. They have like, it's called ankle, right? So it's like flatter in the softer parts and harder in the heart. In the harder X-rays, they are harder. And what we propose for that is that these two quantization continua are coming from the different they are coming from different parts. So one continuum is coming from the disk quantization, whereas the other comes from the synchrotron quantization. And so that you have this both of these components. And because you have the disk, which is further away than this like, hot accretion flow, you actually have a delay between these two. So when you have the propagating fluctuations coming closer to the black hole, they first they are first reflected as the disk quantization and coming to the observer here. But then they are propagated further down to the innermost regions where you have the synchrotron. And then they are again coming to the observer in the form of the synchrotron quantization. And then when once you have the two light curves shifted, so one from the disk, and the other from the synchrotron. In the power spectra, what you have is this cross term between these two components. Basically, what you see is the interference picture in the power spectrum, and that's exactly what produces these peaks it's multiple peaks. And interestingly, if you try to attribute this time to the viscous time in the hot accretion disk, you can infer these parameters from the hot flow just from fitting these peaks in the power spectrum. So that this for the.
This is amazing. So, which peak corresponds to what then?
So if you have the peak because of this cosine term.
Yes.
And this cosine term depends on the viscous time scale.
Right.
So when you assume the viscous time, like when you
each peak is some sort of viscous time scale on the disk. It's
it's only one time.
They're harmonics.
Yeah, they're either harmonics or like the odd numbers of. Well, it's like here, for example, you have harmonics. So this is just the cosine term which produces you the peaks. And then from the frequency of the first peak, say, you can get this viscous time scale.
I see. Got it. Okay.
So you know, I mean, to get alpha out of that, you would know the distance that you between these two regions.
Yes, that's what you have to assume for the truncation radius. So, I mean, this is you can assume. Yeah. So basically, you have this viscous timescale from the frequencies of the peaks. Then you assume the black hole mass for the object, and then you have to get an estimate for the truncation radius. It can be too far away because you see, like you assume that you have to see two components, but it cannot be too close either, because then you will be dominated by this Compton disk Comptonization.
So sorry, am I getting this right? So by just doing this interference between these two Comptonizing soft photon populations, basically, you're able. These are the types of QPOs as well, right? Or they're just
not
the
ones,
or the
QPO above them, top of that. They're on top of that, yeah.
No, I mean, okay. There's the QPO is like here. This is one,
okay.
But then you have these peaks here, or like
it.
Peak
got it, got
here,
it, got it, got
like
it.
Six.
Okay. So this just explains why you have multiple Lorentz in addition.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
So before you translate this into alphas and H over R's, what are the actual numbers for the viscous time scale that you get out?
I don't remember which for which. I think this one is 0.13
seconds.
Yes.
0.13 seconds.
Yes, 0.13. And this is about 0.4.
Okay.
As far as that, maybe the other way around. But this is like the hot disk, which means you would expect.
Well, so that's why I was asking, because now you basically translate them to theoretical numbers, right? Alpha and H over R to understand the theory,
yes.
Right? But I think that the actual values of the viscous that you get from this, you know, independent on how you interpret those,
yes.
Is very interesting to understand, try and understand and see where that fits. And that's why I was asking.
Yeah, that's just like this is just one number in the formula here, right? So.
But
if
it's the one that you actually derive,
yes,
from your,
yes, exactly.
From your inference model, right?
Yeah. Okay, let's now move to the optical emission again. So for the optical emission in the time domain, what would you expect is, for example, if we had the irradiated disks, then if we have some aperiodic variability in the X-rays, then we will assume that this variability will be delayed and probably smeared in the optical, because the optical is coming from the outer parts of the accretion disk. So, like, okay, delayed and smeared. And this is something like which sometimes is seen. For example, in this object, these are the cross correlation function of the like UV X-ray. The dashed lines here are zero lag, and the positive lags correspond to the optical delays. So once you see the peak in the at the positive lags means that the optical is lagging, or the UV is lagging the X-rays. But then sometimes you see a completely different structure of the cross-correlation for these objects, which shows a negative correlation, which is preceding the X-rays. So, and this was not at all clear. How would you explain? I mean, because you cannot explain, expect something of that with the reprocessing. And it was observed in a number of objects with different, a little bit different morphology of the cross-correlation, but the deep is still there. And what we proposed is that this anticorrelation is actually coming from the hot accretion flow, so from the synchrotron self-contact mechanism there. So when I
can you go back to the beginning? How should I interpret these phrases in 1118?
Because you say there's a leading delay, right? But there's also a lag, right? So
yeah, there is an anticorrelation, but on top of that there is a positive correlation and positive flux, which means that the part of the optical is coming as negatively correlated with the X-rays and somewhat before. But there is also it all then after the X-ray, like say, if you're considering the X-ray flares, say, then there is
right,
so a positive flux, it correlates.
So that you would explain with reprocessing?
Basically, so that second peak, so basically the positive peak, you would explain with reprocessing.
Yeah, exactly.
But you're saying that the fact that it's before the
But you cannot explain anything with reprocessing, like this kind of the anticorrelation before the X-rays.
Do you ever see them only with the leading the X-rays, so that there's no peak after that?
Ask me afterwards. Okay, so let's move on to this. Positive peak would not be would not be problematic to explain with the reprocessing. But then you need to explain this negative correlation. And what we proposed is that the negative correlation actually comes from the optical, which is coming from the hot accretion flow. So when when I plot the average spectrum for this hot accretion flow, which is in black here, and then I try to vary the parameters, and I assume that, say, my luminosity is varying with the accretion rate, so like the more accretion rate I have, the more luminosity I will get. But then at the same time, you also have an increase in the number of particles, so like electron number density. But then, if you have an increased number density, you have an increased self-absorption. So, which means when you have the X-ray flare for the increased mass accretion rate, you have an optical dip because of the increased self-absorption of these photons. And then the vice versa. So you have this anticorrelation of the synchrotron and X-rays in the hot accretion flow. And then, combining with the reprocessing, you can get this shape, like zigzag shape here. Okay.
Those are not time separated, are they? Just total spectral correlations. But what about the time between, like, X-ray would go off, then you get reprocessing.
Yes.
In that reflection. But in the other case, what's the temporal relation?
Well, it depends whether you have these optical photons at the same region with the X-rays, or they can be actually more extended. And it seems that we see both. Like, just fitting the other cross-correlation functions, it seems that.
The plot on the left is actually peaked at zero lag or lead, right?
Yeah, this anticorrelation here, If we assume that they're coming from the same region, they are picking a zero lag. Of course, there can be some small, the optical can be preceding a little bit the X-rays. But as far as I try to fit the data, we don't see much. So either the delay is small or there is no.
Only the blue delay, basically, it's like a Pisigny profile, right? So you need to combine the effect of both of them. Except this is in time, of course.
Yeah, well, yes.
But it's the same thing that combines to give you this profile.
Yes. see. So one of the objects we analyzed, our favorite, SWIFT 1753, and it actually had a few data sets, simultaneous data sets in the X-rays and the optical, and in the one taken in the outburst peak showed a simple reprocessing feature, which means that, okay, you could expect that you have the accretion disk coming closer to the black hole and you won't see much of this hot accretion flow there, and you only see the positive peak. But in the outburst tail, you see this weird shape with the like anticorrelation dip. And that's exactly what we expect, how these things should evolve. So you have an expansion of the hot accretion flow, which would produce you this negative correlation. But then, as the things get simpler, we start to have another weird cross-correlation. And this time, for the same object, but this anticorrelation, anticorrelation is at positive flux. And this was quite challenging to model. And again, we tried to explain it with two X-ray components, so that you have first you have the X-rays from the discontinuation, and then you have the decrease or anticorrelation of the optical X-rays, which are coming after the first X-rays here, but then you have again the next X-ray component from the synchrotron continuation, and then you can actually fit this very strange shape of the cross-correlation function. Okay, so this what concerns the aperiodic variability. Now let's switch to the quasi-periodic oscillations. First of all, we didn't speak too much about that.
Actually, before you go on to that, can I ask a question I wanted to ask earlier? So the infrared access that you had pointed out earlier, which is actually coming from the hot flow, does that also show high RMS aperiodic variability?
Yeah, well, it's high RMS periodic variability, yes, in the optical as well. I mean,
And with similar lags and leads relative to the optical? With similar lags and leads relative to the...
Well, for example, in this case, in this object, there is no infrared simultaneous observations, unfortunately. There are, for other objects, there are observations, and optical has different structure, optical cross-correlation function has different structure from the infrared. But then again, infrared cross-correlation varies in time. And you cannot, it sometimes seems that you can explain it with this hot accretion flow, but whereas in the other outburst stages, you probably cannot. But I mean, we can, if you want, explain you in more detail about that. So the QPOs. So there are three types of the QPOs which we observe in these objects, which are called ABC. Basically, this is the Q diagram, and there are these so-called type C QPOs, which are often, which are shifting in the frequency range, and they are seen in most of the cases, most of the time of the outburst, most of the lifetime of the outburst. And I will mostly, say something about them. There are also other types which have a little bit different properties, which are sketched here. And these are observed at the soft intermediate states. So the type C QPOs, this is one of the examples of very nice quality data. So it has at least two QPOs here, which you see. This is the fundamental, and this is the is harmonic, or the first harmonic or second harmonic, if you want. Usually, these type C QPOs, they come. like with at least one harmonic, and often they show also a subharmonic, which is a little bit, which has a little bit smaller quality factor. But they all three, they are moving in frequency, and they appear at about in this frequency range. Interestingly, the QPOs were also observed in the optical wavelengths, and they seem to be at the same frequencies as the X-ray QPOs. So now the question is, how do you produce this kind of optical QPOs? Even more interestingly, the cross-correlation function shows this kind of oscillations, the optical optical X-ray cross-correlation function, which means that these two QPOs are not only, you know, having the same frequency, but they also phase connected. Even more interesting, this phase connection here. So this is the phase flux of the across the frequencies, and the phase flux have more or less they're more or less constant. But at the QPO frequency, there is a sudden drop, which means that the optical, though the aperiodic variability has its own connection. From the optical aperiodic variability has its own connection to the X-rays, the quasi-periodic oscillations in optical and X-rays are coming in phase. So, like, once you see they like have mostly like more or less zero phase shift. And discussing what would produce this kind of quasi-periodic oscillations, there were a number of kinematic models. But most of them, they have difficulties explaining the frequency range. Also we have another proof. Like recently, there was a proof that there was iron line shifting its energy, peak of the iron line, which means that you, like at the different QPO phases, you observe different parts of the accretion disk, and that's probably, as far as I know, can only be explained by this model where you have the length steering precession of this hot accretion flow, which is radiating to the outer parts of the disk. And then, okay, so we have this accretion flow which is precessing around the black hole spin. We have this nice kinematic model which Chris was developing, and like not only Chris, but. But then the question is, how would you produce, like, if you want to explain the QPOs, you have to explain how the spectra or like the X-ray photons are produced there. And in this like purely kinematic model, you cannot explain the presence of harmonics in the X-rays. And what we proposed is that, we started with this precessing precessing disk or precessing hot flow. And we recalled that the main process responsible for the X-rays is the comptonization. But then this comptonization has a certain emission pattern. And for the hot accretion flow, it turns out this emission pattern has two peaks which are away from the away from the axis of this hot flow. So if you think that the hot flow is like a plate, then it radiates most of the emission to the sides of that. And so as it processes, it shows, like it points towards you either one or like then another peak of this emission. And that's how you get the harmonics then. At the same time, the optical emission is produced from the optically more or less thick, in the optically thick region, which means that most of the emission would be pointed towards the axis of this hot flow, where you see most of the surface area. And in this case, you would expect to have the phase shift between X-ray and optical QPOs either zero or pi, depending on where you observe the system. So, for example, in this, if you observe it like Adron or close to the Adron, you will have emission, increased emission simultaneously in X-rays and in X-rays and optical. But if you observe it like face on, then the peak you would in the optical you would expect when it faces towards you, but at the same time you would expect the dip in the X-rays. In this case, you would have a pi. So from that, so in this case, so the optical is produced in the outer parts of the accretion flow, and the X-rays are produced in the innermost parts, and you can deduce the inclination for the system just from observing the phase lags between optical and X-rays. And well, for this Swift 1753, this would infer inclination more than about 50 degrees.
Sorry, this inclination is of the orbital
inclination.
Of the orbital. In other words, of the outer disk.
Yes.
Is there a binary orbital inclination measurement for that system?
No, for this system not. There are like indications that you cannot have it too small.
It's certainly completely consistent with being greater than 50.
Well, 40, 50, but you can argue, but.
Is there a constraint on this? Viscosity from the some match between the lens theory and this damping time and precession time.
Yeah, well, probably Chris would know better, but as far as I understand, this precession period would mostly be dependent on the extent of this hot flow.
Yes, I think this is a little different. So this isn't the. This isn't the warp radius where those two balance out. Yeah. This is a hot, thick flow that's entirely tilted.
That's makes sense. So it's totally in the inside.
Yeah.
Okay, so now we're coming to the point that we actually can explain, hopefully, all this very strange things, combining this aperiodic variability, aperiodic cross correlation together with the QPO, and we actually can get fairly well constrained, fairly well modeled timing properties of this object. Okay, now let's go to the last. My last point is the long-term behavior, and I promised to show this picture about this Jiggs 339-4. So what's plotted here is that you have the like decline stage, and the X-rays, the hard X-rays, they start to like they emerge here at this point. This is the light curve, which is this in days. What is it? This is about 20 days. And so when you have decreasing X-ray emission, at the same time, you often see the optical flares here and also the radio flares. But if you try to check like what's the date when you have the peak of the radio emission, it's a little bit before what you see in the optical. And what I was saying that you actually probably see the emergence of the radio emission is just because the green points, you can see the green points here. And well, for me, there is a rather abrupt increase in the X-rays here.
And you're saying that's the other part of the jet line and the lower part of the Q diagram.
Yes, it's the low part of the Q diagram, so it's like the decline stage already. So even more interesting is these are the spectra corresponding to.
Christian.
I don't know. Night looks good.
Yeah. Well, let's see at the spectra. These are the radio points for these epochs here, which are marked. And these are the optical infrared points. If you start extrapolating the jet, when you have the points in the mid infrared or submillimeter here, like Herschel points here, then you start like you see that your radio is going up here, and there is a problem with connecting these points which show also an excess emission above the accretion disk. So there is a problem with connecting this to you with something reasonable, because here in the inset there is a slope, there are these green points from this observation. And after you subtract the accretion disk contribution, this excess shows a rather flat slope here. And there's really a problem to explain it with this jet here.
How are you getting the outer disk radius again?
The outer disk radius?
So the disk must cut off at some point. Right.
Yeah, well, there's just a Rayleigh jeans tail.
And how do you determine the location of the outer disk?
Oh, well, you can more or less construct, I'm not sure how do they do it here, but I mean, here you know this is the GX339-4, where you know the period, which means that you know more or less the geometry there, and then you can say but where the disk will cut off. So, another example is this 1550. It also showed an outburst in 2000, and this is the X-ray the X-ray points. So it first was in the hard state, which is shown with blue. Then it was like an intermediate state with black, and then the soft state with red. And then at the same time, these blue points here correspond to these blue points here. And the others as well, the optical and infrared long-term behavior showed a very strange shape. So it had these flares during the hard state. During the hard state, there are two flares. So it's not only the fast rise exponential decay, which we would expect from the white dwarfs. There are also an excess emission by an order of magnitude, at least. And one way to, there's clear an additional component which is emerging, and one way to extract the spectrum of this additional component is that just to assume that you have an exponential decay here. We don't have points here, but at least you can at least somehow extend these points down, and then get the spectrum of this component. And interestingly, what it shows, these are again these two, the light curves, these are the spectra, and this is the spectrum of this flare, of the additional component. It shows that the flare starts with a very hard spectrum. It's alpha of about 1. Then it goes down to about 0, minus 0.2, but then it goes back again to about 1. And it's, I think it's really interesting to see, because this is something which is not coming from the accretion disk. This is exactly what you expect from the non-thermal particle distribution. Again, the argument against the jet would be just because you would be really in trouble making this very hot index 1. For the jet. So this is the color magnitude diagram for this outburst, and the points, these are how the points go. So it starts with quiescence, then it goes up, and then when this flare starts, you can see that the color immediately changes. So it becomes redder, which means that you have a red component there. Then they come back to the more or less black body track, which is plotted here with black line, and then it goes down. But then there is again the second flare here, which then declines towards the quiescence here. And the green lines here are the additional component, the flare here. This is the spectrum or the magnitude here, and again we see that there is it starts with 1, goes to about 0, and then goes back to 1 again. The explanation which we give is that why you have this spectrum, very hot spectrum here, is just because you have an emergence of the hot accretion flow, so which expands. It means that first you have a very compact zones here, and you don't have much of the emission in the infrared. But then when this the disk recedes and it grows in size, it contributes more and more to the optical and infrared, and then you start to go to this multiple component contribution, which produces you the power law of the spectral index about zero. So what happens at the decay is now puzzling. It might be that this hot accretion flow, the structure of the hot accretion flow changes, and this again, this spectral one would be expected for the stratified, if the hot flow is very stratified, so that you have like the fast decrease of the magnetic field or like fast change of the numbered electron number density. And I would be really interested if you see something like that in the simulations.
Can you be specific about what you're expecting and what you'd like the simulations to show? So
that you have a very stratified, so like you have like magnetic field high, say in the, well, the absolute values are not very critical, but because this spectral index depends a lot on the dependence on radius of these parameters, we would prefer to have this, like strong dependence on the parameter on the radius.
We'll talk later. Okay.
And you expect this only to happen in this transition, right, from either the rise to an outburst or from an outburst?
Well, we see the flares two times. First at the rising phase. There is this flare, and you can see that it's like the color is different here, and at the decay time here, which it happens again. But the problem is that we only can deduce the spectral index at the decay stage, because you know what you are extrapolating here. Because at the fast rise, you cannot distinguish between. It's really hard to distinguish between the flare and the accretion disk. So,
because one of the things that is puzzling, but Phil would know better, is that in a lot of these systems, the optical and probably also the infrared actually shows flaring on short time scales at pretty large amplitudes. And it's something that bugged me forever, because I think the time scale over which that flaring occurs is way too short to be the viscous time scale of the disk. So something else is contributing to the flaring in these systems.
So what time scale are you speaking about?
Like hours.
Hours? Is it V's 405?
It can be shorter than me.
Yeah, we see the second variability. Oh.
Yeah, but what I was...
This is much smoother.
This is like a long term. So if you're speaking about this short term variability...
Well, I'm just trying to think of whether a similar mechanism could explain that type of flaring as well. I'm not sure.
But I mean, the short-term variations can also be explained by the variations in the mass accretion rate, right? So, like, but
obscuration of the mass motions around it, but this is different.
But perhaps you were thinking about this V404, right? System or.
Before
Fosigny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very fast.
Yeah. So I think the mechanism there is quite different from what we observe here.
It's completely different.
Yeah, I think it's.
Okay, so this is just my summary for the advertising the model. Yes. Very good model, naturally accounts for the 100 keV temperature, which is difficult to explain in some other models, and explains a bright optical infrared emission and flex spectra, which we see. It also can explain the anticorrelation, which we observe in the cross-correlation function. Interestingly, it explains the phase-connected optical and X-ray QPOs, and from which we actually can get something interesting, like the inclination of the system. This is also, this model is consistent with the propagating fluctuations, because it's just the accretion disk but it's just the mechanism for producing the radiation is slightly different from the standard accretion disk here. And also, we can, in terms of this model with two quantization continuum, we can understand the multi-peak X-ray power spectra from which we can make constraints on the parameters of the accretion flow. Well, I didn't speak too much about that, but actually from the long-term optical flares, when you start to compare the time scales of which you have the decay time scale like characteristic, you can actually make constraints on the extinction towards the object. And it would be really great to see if we have such kind of accretion flows, like stratified accretion flows, if we see this in simulations. And just a few open questions I would be really much interested in is just first, I would be interested in the origin of these non-thermal particles. So which processes give rise to them? What are the slopes like which these particles have? What are their energetics and so on? Then I would be really interested in the simulations of the accretion flow and jet connection, in particular in terms of in terms of the transition, so that you have the increased radio emission, but you don't have the increased optical emission, which is coming actually afterwards. So this would be very interesting for me. And also, I think the most important thing for the from the observation point of view to discriminate the jet and accretion flow models is to have observations in the mid-infrared and sub-millimeters, where you actually can see when you start to extrapolate the radio points, would they be on the same power law, or like would it be possible to connect the radio radio emission of the jet to the infrared and optical emission through these sub-millimeter points? And there are a few open questions on the variability. There's still, I think, no consensus of the whether you have this brace in the power spectra, whether they correspond to the viscous timescale or to the dynamical timescale. And here, actually, I think that it's not only important to have the simulations, which apparently it is very important, but also to understand the radiative processes, because you might, on the one hand, have this disk quantization, which produces one thing, and then the synchrotron quantization, which would probably be on the different timescale. Yeah, another thing is interesting to check with the simulations is the appearance of the subharmonics of the QPOs, which we often observe in the X-rays. And there are also QPOs in quiescent. This is a very challenging, I think, to understand them. Thank you very much.
If you just go back to the previous slide again, I guess it was the one before that, with that peak is so intriguing. Paul commented on these variations. It's also reminiscent to me of the secondary peaks that have been seen in quite a few of the transients.
Yep.
Now, the explanation, or two of the explanations there, were that in the initial X-ray flare, the radiation of the donor will produce an extra mass transfer burst, but it takes about a month for that to make its way through the disk, and you then get the secondary peak. The other is that it's the X-ray radiation of the outer disk. Jean-Pierre, you might have comments on which of those. More likely.
The comment is that both explanations are obviously wrong.
Okay.
And we don't know. And this is nothing. Some of them goes like that, then down, then for a few months. I mean, 16. No, it's a horror. It should not exist.
Yeah. But they do, Jean-Pierre, so you better explain.
They are also on the rising phase. Because these first flares,
well,
are actually on the rising phase.
Yeah, whether I would call that one of your flares or, I mean, the spectrum changes, that is clear from your nice plot on the right. But whether that is a similar thing, I don't know, or if it's just part of the initial flare of the initial outburst. That I would be very hesitant to make a distinction.
Maybe I missed this, but so you're saying that the flares, I mean, the whole point is that the colors of these flares are telling you something about the, that it's pretty non-thermal, right?
Yes.
Comes red.
Did you mention something? I mean, maybe I missed some of this, but so what's the, so within this picture, what's the mechanism for the flares? Why is there a flare at all? I mean, it's all, you know.
Oh, yes. So the point is when you, let's concentrate on this decay, right? So you have a decay, and then you have a flare, and then there is again the decay. So what happens is that you first have a small, small hole here, right? And you don't have this hot accretion flow, and you only see the irradiated accretion disk there. But then, when you start, when the disk starts to recede, you start to see the optical and infrared emission from this hot accretion flow because it occupies like larger and larger radii. When you have like the most compact zones do not have much of the emission of the optical emission. So you would see emission like optical emission, say at a certain epoch when like say hot flow has certain size. So.
I was very sort of negative about the possibility that they should not exist, which I still believe it should not exist, but since you know, it exists, the only possibility I see of having the required time scale, which I mean, the real problem is that since the optical is reprocessed by the central source, and all the assumptions everywhere usually are that this is flat. But in fact, the disk is not flat, we know it's not flat, the disk is warped. And the only, I've written a paper with two younger colleagues years ago, and this paper is universally hated by most of the community, but we speculate about the role of the warp and the warp, the irradiation of the X-ray irradiation of the warp disk. And the timescale are certainly then not a problem. The problem is, of course, the description of that, and it is purely speculative. But,
well,
it's,
but what about the spectrum? Can you have this kind of...
I'm just saying the little thing. I tell you, the details are not this. But there's a general assumption all these are flat. And there's strong observational evidence that they are not.
Yeah. Well, I would agree. I mean,
because we are all reluctant to model warp disk because we don't know what they do.
Yeah, the trouble with infrared emission, maybe if I comment here, is that it's very bright. So you cannot explain with the given size of the source, which you know, you just cannot get the infrared emission from the thermal emissions. So the size of the disk is not enough to get enough luminosity in the infrared. So it has to be an additional source, non-thermal. So you cannot just get from this size, because you know the temperature in the peak of the outburst, the temperature, let's say, in this source is like 15,000 Kelvin in the peak, and then when it drops, it has to drop there, and the infrared just goes up, and, you know, it has to be an additional non-thermal source.
So can I follow up on what you're saying? So I just want to make sure I understand this. So in your interpretation, these IR flares, it sounded to me like what you were saying, that this is essentially almost a geometric effect, right?
Well, it is just, there is an additional component, which comes when you have a sufficiently large hole here.
Right, but I guess, so I guess my question would be, first of all, so why do you get more than one flare?
There's one on the rising phase when you have the decreasing. So
that's fine. So the But then that's what I was going to get. So then there's a clear prediction then that you should see this in every single outburst. You should always see an IR flare at the beginning and an IR flare at the end.
It depends on whether you have, like, what is the relative contribution of the accretion disk here and the non-thermal component here, whether you will be able to see it, like, if this would be, like, you know, buried down under the accretion disk, like radiated accretion disk contribution, you would not be able to see it at some point. But generally, yes. I mean, if you are probably, depending on the wavelength, yes. You would be able to see it in every single object.
Can I comment? We have more than 10 years, 15 years of data on GX39-4 with SMART, with four filters. And it went into the source went to like 5 outbursts during that time, and you see every time that it's in the hot state, you have infrared excess. Every single time.
Well, does it have a flare?
Because the source is strongly variable, goes up and down. It's not clear where is the outburst starts when it ends, because it just goes up and down all the time. So, but in principle, you see. Once it's in the soft state or intermediate, you see it's more or less consistent with the thermal emission. Once it goes to the hot state, you see additional infrared component, red component. Everything.
Okay, and this, what about other systems? Is it seen in other systems?
I mean, you have 4U15, 4U3, whatever minus charge field, probably knows that. It was an outburst also found some more than 10 years ago. But that was a flare also in the paper by Braxton.
So if I may ask you about the shortest times, because I'm curious in this comprehensive picture of, you know, this hot tilted inner accretion flow. How do you get the 300 and 450 hertz QPS?
Well, the model is not for this high frequency QPS. That's only for low frequency QPS type C, which means to like 10.
But we know they're observed, so they must.
Yeah, well, I mean, they might be from different mechanisms. Oh, you also observe type B QPS, which are probably not the precession here. So there are another. You have to assume some other mechanism. Yeah, it's not within this model.
Okay, so the non-thermal emission has to come from like a collisionless plasma region, and I wondered if there were any, and that sort of would be built into the model, the hole would start at some radiation. I wondered if there was a constraint that you could place on where that radius would be from some of the variability measurements.
Well,
some independent constraint other than just the,
So, like, if you consider the optical emission, say, from this you probably somehow can get a constraint when you have the appearance of this component.
Because you know that would have to be done.
Yeah. Well, for example, we have the modeling for this Swift 1753, and we have this spectral modeling, and depending on the place where you have a cutoff, in the spectrum, the low energy cutoff, you would make some constraints on the on the size, and it's like 20 Schwarzschild radii, then probably more, because the decline at the like outburst tail, you only see like the power, you don't know where it drops off.
Okay, why don't we call it quits? Thank you so much, Alexandra. This is really stimulating. And let me remind you that for those of you who still have energy, and there are refreshments, coffee and everything to boost your energy.
Wine and cheese.
Well, that's even later. There are no refreshments when they have wine and cheese. Okay, well, then you can go to Broida Hall at 3:45 for coffee and tea if you want to go to Jan Fischering's club, which will be on radiation energy simulations and accretion funds.
Why would I try?